From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. In Brazil, massive protests over the weekend calling for the president's impeachment. In Argentina, surging inflation and ongoing drama in the death, perhaps murder, of a prosecutor investigating conspiracy and bombing. In Venezuela, economic disaster, political crackdown. It is a tough season for some big players in South America. Countries facing tough new economic realities with oil prices way down and more, and big political corruption scandals. This hour on Point, we're looking at South American turmoil in Brazil, Argentina, Venezuela. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Why so much trouble in one surge in South America? Are we talking about your home country? What do you see? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. It has been a wild season of protests in Brazil. People bring out the pots and pans whenever the president, Dilma Rousseff, comes on to talk to the country. Here they are earlier this month. They don't want to hear it, and there are a lot of reasons why. With us first today from Rio de Janeiro, in Brazil, Lourdes Garcia Navarro, South American correspondent for NPR. Lourdes, thank you very much for being with us today.
My pleasure, Tom.
So what's the latest? We had Dilma Rousseff on TV yesterday talking about corruption. What's she saying? Why is she out front on this now?
Well, I mean, you heard it right there, why she has to be out front on it now. Her popularity right now is at 13%. This is only 4 months after her reelection. So, you know, historic lows for a president in their second term, at the very beginning of their second term. She's facing challenges from within her party, also within her coalition. There are calls for her to be investigated by the opposition for her possible role in a massive corruption scandal here that involves the state oil company. So things are not looking very good for Dilma Rousseff. Very weak presidency right now. A lot of people very unhappy with her.
How high up the government ladder, the political ladder, has this corruption scandal gone? Describe it to us, Lourdes.
It has gone, I mean, pretty much at this point. I was actually at a cocktail party last night, and people were talking about how no one has been left untouched almost by this. The state oil company Petrobras is really one of the crown jewels of Brazil. It is, a very, very important company to the economy. And so when all this corruption was uncovered, basically it has touched every single party, it seems, and everyone. We have so far being investigated the head of the Senate, the head of the lower house of Congress, 50% of the Congressional Ethics Committee, and the list goes on. I know. So far, President Dilma Rousseff is not being investigated, although many people say, why not? She was the head of the board of directors of Petrobras while all this was going on, and this was institutionalized corruption, institutionalized graft. Basically, what we know so far is that all of the biggest construction companies pretty much in Brazil were overcharging Petrobras. They were using that money to then funnel it into slush funds for the ruling party and other parties' political campaigns. So this touches on politics, this touches on business, this touches on the very sensitive topic of corruption.
And this has gone right up to the top officers of the president's political party. She's been running to try to keep ahead of this. Huge protests on Sunday. On Tuesday, Brazil's president spoke to the country after close to a million demonstrators had marched in cities around Brazil on Sunday. Here she was talking about corruption.
Nós temos todos aqui absolutamente.
All of us here completely agree with this demand by the people, and we have a clear determination to take measures that intensify the fight against corruption.
Apparently that wasn't enough. Yesterday she was on again talking about a specific series of anti-corruption measures in the wake of those huge nationwide rallies.
Eu sei, tenho convicção.
Dilma Rousseff saying, I know and have conviction we must investigate and punish the corrupt in a fast and effective manner. It's important to highlight that in Brazil there was no law until today that penalized money laundering or kickback crimes. So from now on, she's saying here, those are crimes. This call for impeachment, I mean, as you say, Lourdes, she was just elected 4 months ago. Is that serious? Is there a chance she will leave office?
I mean, that is, like I said, the parlor conversation at the moment. I mean, at this point, impeachment pretty much has the same implications in Brazil as it does in the United States. You have to have been shown to be have committed a crime. And so far, she has not been shown to have committed a crime. She is not even under investigation. So it's difficult to see how she would be impeached. However, what analysts say is that she, her coalition, could break apart. Basically, the government could basically fall. She could, you know, basically see that Brazil becomes ungovernable, and she would have to resign. So, you know, we are looking at a very difficult period, a period where there are a lot of backdoor negotiations going on between the different coalition partners. I mean, just yesterday, we saw the education minister. He went in front of Congress and he basically berated all her alliances within Congress, saying, you know, you guys are betraying the government. You guys are acting like the opposition. And they were so incensed that they basically said, we will, the biggest party in her coalition said, we will actually withdraw from the coalition unless you fire this guy. And then, of course, the news came out shortly thereafter that his resignation had been accepted. So, you know, we're seeing a lot of turmoil here within the government. They really don't know what to do about this. They don't know how to get ahead of these protests, how to basically consolidate their power again and move forward.
And that's just the political slash corruption side of the ledger. They've got big problems they're facing on the economic side, the environmental side. We've heard so much from you and others, Lourdes, about water problems in Sao Paulo. What about the economy? Yeah. Is it all oil here? Is there a bigger commodity problem?
No.
What's going on?
I mean, you know, they have just gotten bad news after bad news. I mean, I'm going to give you a few numbers. Okay. Sugar's down 24% on the year. Coffee's down 29% on the year. Soybeans are down 32% on the year. These are all big commodities that Brazil exports. Inflation is up 8%. And we have the real, the Brazilian currency, just massively sliding. You know, the economic outlook here is really, really grim. And what makes this really important is because Dilma Rousseff was really trying to pass these measures that the international, international investors and were really looking to see them pass so that basically Brazil could get back on track. And because of all the corruption scandals and all the political problems, that simply hasn't happened. It's sort of overshadowed everything. And so basically the economy is in a kind of free fall where very little is being done to address the real underlying problems here.
We're going to go north to Venezuela. I want to look south first at Argentina, another scene of difficulty right now. Jonathan Watts joins us, also in Rio, but been in Argentina recently. He is Latin American correspondent for The Guardian. Lourdes Garcia Navarro, stand by. Jonathan Watts, welcome back to On Point. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, good to be on the show again.
The main issue we've heard out of Argentina is this scandal over the death of a prosecutor, murder, suicide, not clear, looking into conspiracy around a bombing at a Jewish community center there years ago. But at the same time, we've got inflation, bad inflation in Brazil, but far worse in Argentina. What's the level of upset in Argentina these days, Jonathan?
It's extremely high. It has been high for more than a year. Largely because inflation is at really alarming levels and and disturbing people's day-to-day lives. But now you've had this remarkable political scandal associated with the death of the prosecutor, Mr. Nisman. And this combination of factors has led to hundreds of thousands of people going out on the street in protest of what they see as corruption, the lack of transparency over the investigation, and the poor state of the economy. So, as in Brazil, you're seeing huge public resentment towards the authorities in Argentina. And these both countries previously had, I mean, they both have populist governments, but these populist governments appear to be losing the streets.
And we can hear that right here. This is January, after the death of the federal prosecutor, Alberto Nisman. Argentines not happy there. It was the day before, the night before he was supposed to go public, we're told, with a lot of potentially incriminating information. Lots of questions around the president herself. She talked with the press that month, very, very defiant here, after the death of Prosecutor Nisman.
No one is going to blackmail me. No one is going to intimidate me. I'm not afraid of them. They can say what they like, make the accusations that they want to. Let the judges call me. May the prosecutors denounce me. It doesn't bother me. But they're not going to move me one centimeter from what I have always thought.
Okay, maybe she protesteth too much, Argentina's president there, Cristina Fernanda Kirchner. So what about the stability of this government, the prospects for this economy, Jonathan?
Well, it's looking like a very rough year for Argentina. Even if President Kirchner can weather this storm, she will, in any case, come to the end of her term at the end of this year. So there is an election to replace her in October, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And so she's effectively a lame-duck president, who's in charge of a very badly performing economy. And just as Lila was saying, the Argentine economy is very reliant on commodities, and we are seeing behind all of the problems in Latin America at the moment, we are seeing the end of the commodity super cycle. And that is in particular because Chinese demand has fallen for all of these basic goods, foodstuffs, iron ore, oil, all of these things. As the Chinese economy has gone down, the demand for those things have gone down, and big exporters of commodities like Argentina, like Brazil, like Venezuela in the case of oil, they're all suffering. They're all feeling the pinch. And I think the prospects for all of them this year are extremely grim, and probably not just this year, but for a while to come.
Lourdes Garcia Navarro, do you see that? The economic stress lying beneath all the political turmoil, or is it the other way around?
No, I think definitely, you know, we're seeing the economy really having a huge effect. I mean, if you think when the pink tide, as it was so called back in the day, when all these leftist leaders sort of came to power and they promised massive social spending and, you know, an increase in the middle class, moving people up. And that did happen. But now we're seeing that change. And so people are feeling resentful. They're saying that you are not fulfilling your promises.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about turmoil in South America, Venezuela, Brazil, Argentina, and more, dealing with a lot of upheaval right now in their politics, their economies. We're looking at why and the way ahead with Jonathan Watts, Latin American correspondent for The Guardian, joining us from Rio de Janeiro, as well as Lourdes Garcia Navarro, South America correspondent for NPR, also in Rio. Behind us right here, Brazilian protesters, this was Sunday, calling for the president there, Dilma Rousseff's impeachment. Lots of unhappiness in the streets. In Argentina, the death of a prosecutor who had aimed his, apparently, investigation very high in that country caused all kinds of tension. Here was what prosecutor Viviana Fine talking with reporters about how his body was found in January, interpreted here by France 24.
I can confirm that a .22 caliber weapon was found beside the deceased. The death was caused by gunshot.
Go north to Venezuela and you've got deep economic distress, very heavily dependent on oil. And of course, oil is way down. Venezuela imports a huge portion of its consumer goods. Food lines have grown long for food and other staples. Wealthier Venezuelans now paying surrogates to stand in food lines. Here's Elizabeth, mother of two, a housekeeper for a Venezuelan family. She stands in line for up to 5 hours, 6 days a week for that family, here talking with CCTV in December.
My boss gives me the list of things to buy. I get in the line in the afternoon, and sometimes I have to wait in another line later in the day, depending on what products arrive. I found this a little unfair. All humans are supposed to be equal, but I have to do this, and they don't, just because they were fortunate.
Not easy in Venezuela. Jonathan Watts, Lourdes Garcia Navarro, please stand by. With us right now, Harold Trincunas, senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, director of their Latin America initiative, born and raised in Venezuela. Harold Trincunas, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
We saw all the Chavez years and a big push to push resources to the poorer in Venezuela. Now oil is way down. What's happening? Is this an inevitable result of the loss of their major revenue stream? Is there something else going on, Harold?
Well, Undoubtedly, the loss of a major source of revenue, the reduction in the price of oil from approximately $110 per barrel last year to as low as 40 this year, is a major source of the problems Venezuela is experiencing today. But we have to remember they were already experiencing scarcity and high inflation even when oil was at $110 per barrel. A lot of this is the product of the government's policies. We also have to understand that during the commodity boom that Venezuela experienced during the past 10 to 15 years, the government really didn't save any of these revenues, even though it had a law in place that was supposed to act to create a buffer to accumulate reserves that Venezuela would be able to use during tough times. However, they didn't do that. They spent that money.
So we also have a tremendous tension now between Caracas and Washington, Venezuela and the United States. What's that all about? They've ordered the U.S. Embassy to cut its staff by 80%. President Obama is calling Venezuela a national security threat and ordered sanctions. Why?
Well, the U.S.-Venezuela relationship has been rocky for a long time. And from the perspective of President Maduro, the president of Venezuela, creating a polarized situation with Washington plays to his advantage. It helps him to rally his base and distract Venezuelans from the problems at home. That said, the United States also has been going through a process of becoming more and more critical of human rights violations and erosion of democracy and democratic institutions in Venezuela, including passing a law last December. So the declaration of Venezuela as a national security threat and the passing of the sanctions derives from that law that was signed by President Obama last December.
Here was the Venezuelan President Maduro. This is lashing out at President Obama last week. Saying here, President Obama will be remembered for his decision today and the aggression against the Venezuelan people, the noble people, peaceful people. He says, Obama, you don't have a right to attack nor to declare that Venezuela is a threat to the people of the United States. The threat to the people of the United States, he says, is you. You decide to invade, to kill, to finance terrorism in the world, a kind of Chavez-ismo still working there. Harold Trincunas, I'm still a little fuzzy on why the U.S. would call Venezuela a national security threat. Is it in any material way true that it's a real national security threat to the United States? It seemed to play right into Maduro's hand.
Well, I think Maduro has used the language that was included in the executive order declaring Venezuela a national security threat to his advantage, not only to rally support at home, but also to rally support from other governments in the region.
But why would the U.S. do it? I mean, is there any – why?
The language on Venezuela being a national security threat comes from the International Emergency Economic Powers Act, which is the legal framework that allows President Obama to impose targeted sanctions against the individuals in Venezuela who are accused of violating human rights. So to legally impose targeted sanctions, he has to use those phrases that are in the law, declaring Venezuela a national security threat and a national declaring a national emergency over this. So it's the same language that's used, for example, to sanction Russia or Iran or even Libya back in the day.
Now, Brazil and Argentina, Jonathan and Lourdes have been taking us through there. There's been a lot of public protest, but it's stayed in a fairly democratic context. Venezuela, different on that score, and there's been a real crackdown on opposition. Can you describe some of that to us, Harold, including, I think, the mayor of Caracas arrested with a squad with automatic weapons?
Absolutely. And I think you're pointing to one of the big differences between the situation in the situations of these three countries. In Brazil and to somewhat lesser extent in Argentina, you still have institutions that can handle the protests in a democratic fashion within the constitutional construct in each of those countries. In Venezuela, institutions have been eroded. And increasingly, we're seeing the government act against the opposition with very few limits on its power. So following a set of nationwide protests last April, almost a year ago, the government has been taking a much tougher line against the opposition, especially those elements of the opposition that have been calling for President Maduro to resign early, to resign before his term is up.
Is there any sign that he may do that?
So far, no. He has taken a very hard line against the opposition. And in fact, there's good reasons to think that he's trying to do everything he can to avoid stepping down. We have to realize that there's a lot of complicity within the Venezuelan government on issues of corruption, on issues of human rights abuses, even allegations of drug trafficking by the military. So there's a lot of people in the Venezuelan government who really can't afford the accountability that might come with the resignation of President Maduro or the opposition having greater power and greater say in the way the country is run.
We're looking at a season of remarkable turmoil in some very big countries in South America with Harold Trinkunas, Lourdes Casir Navarro, Jonathan Watts. Lots of callers for you three. Leo in Charlottesville, Virginia. Leo, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I wanted to make a point that I'm a Venezuelan national. My father and my family, we escaped the Chavez years before he kind of foresaw the problems that were coming. But one of the, I think, common denominators in all these countries is the underlying corruption. You can have the governments from the right and or left in power. And I think the reason why all these governments fail is because there is this culture that just gets passed down. It starts in the families. It starts in the society. And it bleeds into government. And it's the reason why all these governments fail. And until that gets addressed, the price of oil can go up. The price of commodities can go up. You may see some short-term stability. Governments on the left or right, that corruption's what will inevitably make these governments fail.
Leo, to your eye, does it matter if the government is left or right or military tinged or you name it? Does it make a difference?
Historically, I don't think it's made a difference to me. I haven't noticed that difference. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, I appreciate your call, Leo. Let me get one more right here on the Brazil front. A Venezuelan looking at corruption there. Amari in Boston. You're on, Amari.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
It's very interesting. So we had the as your analyst was talking about the economic boom of the commodities.
Yes.
And all those governments, they never really, just from the managing standpoint, never really took care of getting ready for the skinny cow.
They enjoyed the commodity super cycle, as Lourdes puts it, but not the skinny cow that would follow.
Exactly. So then, but it's all due to the populist aspect of those governments. It's very interesting to see if you really look at the whole of Latin America right now. It's very easy to connect all of those, not only in ideological terms, like we mm-hmm. can see, they're all very close friends in a way. They support each other. In Brazil, there's this yearly meeting that is called the Forum of São Paulo, mm-hmm. which connects all basically left-wing, even the most radical parts of it, like the hardcore communist parties. I'm not against social policies or anything like that, but it's very important to connect those dots. You can't just look at Brazil right now and then overlook how people feel about just the general left and against U.S. and stuff like that. You can see that everywhere.
Amari, let us pick it up. Of course, these are countries that also had, especially Venezuela and Brazil, tremendous inequity. But Lourdes, let me bring it to you. I mean, you brought up the pink tide. I'm reading here from the Wall Street Journal, of course, conservative tinge. This was a year ago, kind of op-ed piece here by Daniel Lanau saying there are two Latin Americas now. Now, this was a year and change ago. He says the first is a block of countries, including Brazil, Argentina, and Venezuela, that face the Atlantic Ocean, mistrusts globalization, gives the state a large role in the economy. The second, he was writing then, made up of countries that face the Pacific, Mexico, Peru, Chile, Colombia, embracing free trade and free markets. And him writing then, there's good reason to think the Pacific-facing countries have the edge. How does that look today, Lourdes?
Well, first of all, I remember reading that op-ed, and I disagree with it fundamentally. He ignores Ecuador or Bolivia.
The Pacific, yes. He's picking and choosing carefully to make the thesis work. But the line
exactly.
is maybe a more complicated line, but there's one.
Well, The line is this. I mean, I think if you look at the history of Latin America, it is based on a cycle of boom and busts, and that has been the case for governments from the right and governments from the left.
Yep.
I think what you're seeing right now, though, is, yes, certainly when you had that boom, that commodities boom, there was massive social spending that took place. Look at Brazil. There were celebrated programs under Ignacio Lula da Silva that really brought millions of people out of abject poverty. They did their job. And now that the money is slowing down, that those social programs can no longer be funded in the way that they could be before, that austerity is coming to these countries, you know, clearly people are going to be asking, well, you promised us one thing and are delivering something completely different. And if your political platform is based on trying to reduce inequality and expand social programs, and you are no longer able to do that, you don't have the money to do that, there will be discontent. But I want to make something very, very clear. Although you are seeing Dilma Rousseff's popularity at 13%, which means, of course, she has lost a lot of her base. Many of the people who were out, according to the polls, in Sao Paulo, for example, which was the biggest protest, were basically people who had a conservative leaning. You know, what we are seeing is that after, you know, over a decade of leftist rule, the conservatives are coming back now and saying, we have answers. We have answers. We can fix this. And that might appeal to many different sectors of the population.
Brazilian President Dilma Rousseff, interpreted here by CNN, this was last week, saying, okay, this is democracy. Protests are fine, but let's not get violent here.
We have to treat protest in Brazil with complete calm. Everyone has the right to protest and to criticize whoever it may be. There is just one thing that we cannot accept, that this turns into violence against other people or anyone's property, be it public or private.
Jonathan Watts, there are problems now financing some of the social programs that you can see what the need was in these countries. Does that mean, to your eye, an inevitable sort of swing to conservatism? Is there really an answer there that could address inequity and poverty? What do you see going forward, Jonathan?
I think there is a swing towards the conservative side. A big question will be how far of a swing it will be. Latin American politics for much of the last 50 years has been characterized by very dramatic violent swings between basically right-wing military dictatorships and then 10, 20 years later, leftist popular governments. We are now seeing a point where, and just to go back to something that one of your listeners raised,
yes,
there is a lot of association between the leftist governments of, say, Venezuela, Argentina, and Brazil. But there is quite a broad range within that leftist movement in Latin America. For example, Uruguay is much more pragmatic.
Mm-hmm.
Chile has a leftist government at the moment, but it's also far closer to the center of the political spectrum than is the case in Venezuela. So it's quite a complex picture we have here. But I think the central element, really, for the big three, certainly Brazil, Argentina, and Venezuela, is that all three had populist governments that came to power roughly 10 to 15 years ago. And they came with a lot of hope, a lot of promise, and at the beginning of this really benign economic situation. Now, the economic situation has turned dramatically against them. They can't fund the programs, as you've been saying. And I think, as with any government anywhere in the world, after 10 years, if you haven't delivered on all your promises, the electorates will turn against you. And I think that is what we're seeing happen. And even though these governments, let's recognize this, have made big steps towards reducing inequality in most of these countries, they have made progress in this area. Some of that progress has flatlined. And in the case of Venezuela, you've actually seen an increase in poverty in the last 2 years, quite a dramatic increase in poverty in the last 2 years, which is very much against everything that Chavismo is supposed to be standing for. The latest figures from the United Nations released late last year show, in fact, that the country that's done the best in reducing poverty is relatively moderate Chile, rather than any of the more interventionist leftist governments. This series of factors all bodes very ill for the left. And if you're on the right, or if you're on the center right, you're surely rubbing your hands and thinking, my time has come.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at wbur.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about turmoil in South America, Venezuela, Brazil, Argentina, and more, dealing with upheaval, really, right now in their politics, their economies. We're looking at why and the way ahead with Jonathan Watts of The Guardian with us from Rio, Lourdes Garcia Navarro of NPR from Rio de Janeiro as well, Harold Trincunas, born and raised in Venezuela, joining us today from Washington and the Brookings Institution, director of their Latin America Initiative. Here's in Brazil last week, a woman talking with CNN about why she's concerned about the Brazilian economy, why she's not so optimistic.
No, we are not in a good moment. Inflation is up. Everything is more expensive, like petrol and even food. So no.
No, not optimistic right there. Daniel in Norwood, Massachusetts. Thank you for calling, Daniel. You're on the air.
Yeah, sure. Hi. I'm kind of surprised that there hasn't been any discussion at this point in terms of Argentina about the Argentine debt from the Depression back in 2001 and,
yes,
the settlement for the $100 billion, and it's been blocked and just stopped by an American court in Manhattan and a hedge fund, you know, that claims it wants, like, full payment. I mean, and they can no longer have access to credit internationally, mm-hmm, and it's because of an action taken in the United States in the courts. And I think this has to have a major effect on the Argentine economy. And there's been no discussion of that, and I think it kind of deserves some.
Yes, absolutely. I'm glad you raise it, Daniel. Jonathan Watts, what about this? Is this a bone in the throat of Argentina right now, this suit by an American hedge fund that wants all its money back and won't settle for less?
Absolutely. It is, as your listener pointed out, it's one of the reasons why Argentina is suffering at the moment. There are many others, too. But yes, the lack of access to the international capital markets is a big problem for Argentina.
Harold, is surmountable, insurmountable? I mean, it's a high stakes court fight, but does it amount to a real challenge to the Argentine economy?
This is a problem that actually could be resolved within the next year. The current Argentine government has decided that it prefers to basically kick the resolution of this problem until it's passed the election in the fall. But once that this issue is resolved one way or the other, Argentina will be able to access international capital markets again, which certainly will help it get the kind of bridge financing it needs to compensate for the loss of income from the commodity exports.
Lourdes, how do you think Brazil works with this? Promises were made, social programs were launched, they had a lot of effect, and for years we heard much celebration of Brazil's economic and social success. Now it's facing leaner times, the skinny cow, as our caller said, and we can see the distress in the streets, we see the dissatisfaction in Rousseff's poll numbers. What are their options for dealing with this tougher scenario?
Well, I mean, I think that's exactly what they're trying to figure out. I mean, you know, as any student of economics knows, you can adopt different policy models depending on what your, you know, where you come from on the political spectrum. Dilma Rousseff is actually adopting quite conservative policy models. She has opted for austerity. The person that she has named as her new finance minister is someone who is saying that there has to be decreased spending, that you have to raise taxes. This will, that Brazil now has to basically tighten its belt, so that the days of, lavish funding of social programs and giving money to everyone is over. And so that is something that she has decided is the way forward. Unfortunately, as I mentioned before, she's being stymied by the political situation and the corruption scandal and what's happening within Congress here. But pretty much at this point, if you don't have the money, you don't have the money. So you can either sort of print money and then exacerbate inflation. But inflation is already a big problem here. I mean, let's not forget a lot of these countries have grappled with hyperinflation before, have really dealt with these terrible, terrible specters of just collapsing economies. People that I've spoken to in Argentina and Venezuela, remember vividly their parents or they themselves losing all of their savings, losing everything in different financial crises in the country. So, you know, in Latin America, these issues are not sort of abstract. Mm-hmm. These issues really have a deep, deep personal resonance. And so politics is very personal in Latin America. When people are coming out into the streets and protesting, they're not just protesting an ideology. They're protesting things that they believe are going to actually have a direct effect on their life and their children's lives. It is deeply, deeply personal. These have long, troubled histories. There were dictatorships that killed people, that tortured people. And so, you know, when you see Dilma Rousseff talking about no violence during the protests,
these are not accidental words.
Was tortured herself. Yeah. Yes, these are not accidental words.
Jonathan Watts, what about the depth of the unrest here? It is not hard to scratch the internet and see people rumbling about the military rising again in Brazil. That sounds so unlike what we've seen and heard and so unlike the commitment to democracy that we've seen for these last years. But there's a big history here, Jonathan. Is that considered a real threat or just paranoia?
I think it's definitely a minority who would like this to happen. Although I was at the protest that took place in Copacabana in Rio de Janeiro on Sunday, and I was somewhat shocked at how many people there were calling for military intervention. Now, that probably has more to do with where the protest took place, which was a very affluent white area of Brazil. But nonetheless, there was this group. And there are politicians who speak in Parliament of the need for a military intervention and who speak very in glowing terms of the dictatorship era. But that is a fringe. The vast majority of people, they remember the torture, they remember the killings, they remember the censorship, and they don't want that back again. And I think of the say, a million people who took to the streets last weekend, the vast majority would surely not want to go back to that. So I think with the situation you have in Brazil at the moment, and it is more moderate still than in Argentina, and Argentina is more moderate still than Venezuela, where we saw several dozen people killed in skirmishes between pro- and anti-government groups last year. So there is hope that this could be resolved democratically, but the democracy is only 30 years old. The institutions are pretty strong, but still, they're not that old. And I think they're going to have one of their toughest tests in the next couple of years.
Marcio in Everett, Massachusetts. Marcio, you're on the air.
Thanks, Tom. I see the what is going on in Brazil. I have followed it through the news. And I believe Brazil should invest in infrastructure, build more roads, more bridges, invest in public safety, making sure people is safe to them to walk on the street safely. And we voters have our personal responsibility to make what is good for our country, to behave as good citizens. And that's basically what my point is.
Marcio, I take it you sound Brazilian. I take it you are. What if there's not the money for it? Oil prices are way down. Other commodity prices are way down. Given the need in Brazil and the expectations there and the dissatisfaction we see in the street, what if there's not money to make the kind of improvements that you describe? Or do you think there is enough?
Well, I believe there is enough. Oil will eventually go back up. And that is also, we could have a partnership with the private sector and the public sector. So we have the private sector would build and the public and the government would fiscalize and make sure the money is going to the right direction, make sure there is no corruption, no money being taken away from those investments. The biggest problem in Brazil is corruption, and the code of law sometimes takes too long to be applied, and most of the time the people who has money does never go to jail because because they have a huge number of appealing that they can go through before their case is has a final judgment.
Right. Marcia, I appreciate your call. Harold Trinkunas, I know you look well beyond Venezuela. When you look at Brazil, just take Brazil, what do you see? Is it an issue of means? The money's just not there now with what's happened in the economy? Or is it politics, distribution? Could they accomplish what clearly the people are hoping for there now if they rearrange the way the economy is working, the way taxes work? Is it still possible?
Well, Tom, I think there's certainly a case to be made that Brazil did not spend enough on infrastructure, on education, on the kinds of factors that lead to higher productivity in the economy. The story of Brazil during the past decade is one of incorporating many more people into the working population and into the middle class, but productivity did not increase with that. So that's part of the problem we're seeing today. Now, Brazil can certainly rearrange the way it spends, and it does spend a great deal of money internally to shift some of this from consumption to investment. But much as in the United States, a lot of Brazil's public spending is indexed to transfer programs, and not just to the poor, but also to the middle class.
Social safety net and stuff. You know.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So the president would have to make some adjustments to the economy to make this happen. And I think Brazilians know this. The Minister of the Economy knows this. But unfortunately, as Lourdes said, the president is now spending her political capital defending herself against corruption charges instead of spending that capital to pass the necessary economic measures to accomplish the kinds of things that your caller has pointed to.
Let's go to Cleveland, Ohio. Norman. Norman, thanks for calling. You're on.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
Two things. I'm a music educator here in Ohio, and there is a program of music for children that has come out of Venezuela called La Sistema, and I'm wondering if this program is still going on. I'm also wondering about the health care that Chavez has extended to all the people. I'm wondering if these programs are going on and if the opposition to the government would continue these things. And I'll listen off the air. Thank you.
Norman, thank you for your call. We're looking at turmoil in South America. Harold Trinkunas, what about the, the supporters of Chavez celebrated any number of things that he did there, though there was always a lot of protest from Venezuelans who didn't want to go that way. Here's our caller, Norman, in Cleveland, wondering about, is there an upside? Was it real? Is it intact? And what may happen if the country's politics shift again?
Well, I think that this is clearly one of the issues going forward, is that the programs that were established in Venezuela to address some of the social ills didn't necessarily spend money well. There was a fair amount of corruption associated with them. But now that there's less money available and there's general scarcity, these programs are under severe stress and really are not addressing the needs of the target populations. Taking the healthcare issue first, I think the biggest issue in Venezuela today is really lack of access to medicine and medical supplies that you need to provide effective healthcare. So in a certain way, even though a certain infrastructure was put in place that was able to address the health needs for a much wider number of people than before, the underpinnings of providing effective health care are just no longer available. I would also just note that the music education system, El Sistema, that the caller pointed to actually began before Chavez and was a private initiative, not really a government one. So it came more out of the civil society movement in Venezuela.
Let's go to Oshkosh, Wisconsin. Anna, thank you for calling. Anna, you're on the air.
Thank you for having me. I just want to make a brief comment. If I heard correctly, your guest said that these three governments came to government when things were good. In the case of Argentina, that's wrong. The economy was in shambles at that time, and these governments fixed as much as they could. The problem is that the opposition was linked to the economic chaos, and so now the opposition cannot find a right way of addressing what's going on. So the problem is the opposition, not the government. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you, Ana. Lourdes, what do you say to that? That in all three, they inherited significant problems, and now the opposition isn't in a position to fix what's going off the rails.
Well, there you have it. I mean, there you have the crux of the debate. She's specifically speaking to Argentina. Those weren't part of the comments I made. But yes, I mean, I think absolutely when the Kirchners, President Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner and her late husband and predecessor Nestor Kirchner came over, yes, the economy was absolutely in shambles. I mean, let's not forget, in 2000, 2001, Argentina defaulted on its debt. The economy essentially collapsed. People lost their life savings. It was just an incredible period of crisis. So, you know, absolutely. The Kirchners are credited with really turning that around and making, you know, Argentina into a viable economic system. Now, you could argue that they, you know, what started off well has ended badly. And certainly that is what the opposition might say. People look at Venezuela, people look at Brazil, and they say, okay, yes, you did a lot, but where do things stand right now? And basically, you know, people defend a lot of these governments very passionately. They do believe that the opposition does not have the answer here, as you would in the United States. You would have Republicans and Democrats arguing the same sort of things.
Jonathan Watts, if this is about oil prices having collapsed and commodity prices way down, waiting, our caller says oil will come back. Well, I suppose, but it could be a long wait. Who knows? Other commodities as well. If this is a matter of waiting for those prices to rebound, that could be a long time, Jonathan.
It could be a very long time. As I said earlier, I think the Chinese economy is the key here. It was the Chinese economy that pushed those prices up. And it's the Chinese economy that's now slowing down that is pushing them down. And there is no prospect of the Chinese economy ever going back to its double-digit growth rates, at least not in the foreseeable future. So I think it would be rash to think you can just wait out with the same policies. There does have to be a change. And I would...
I think we're losing you right there, Jonathan. I'm sorry for that, but we're losing our line just as we wrap here. Well, that just comes with the territory. Jonathan Watts in Rio with The Guardian, Latin American correspondent for The Guardian. It's been great to have you with us. Thank you, Jonathan. And Lourdes Garcia Navarro with NPR, South American correspondent, joining us as well from Rio de Janeiro in Brazil today. Lourdes, thank you.
Thank you.
Harold Trinkunas at the Brookings Institution, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.